This podcast may contain adult language and situations, graphic, gory details, and other not-so-nice things. Listener discretion is advised. I'm Ashley.
And I'm Lacey, and this is United States of Murder. This week, we're in Kansas discussing an unusual murder with more questions than answers.
Then we'll talk about a case regarding the internet's first serial killer. So buckle up and join us on this dark and twisted ride through the Sunflower State.
Middle America is a colloquial term for the United States heartland. The geographic center of the contiguous United States is located about 2 miles northwest of Lebanon, Kansas. Kansas is known for its vast plains, wheat fields, and Midwestern values. Speaking for myself, I usually think of friendly folks with a strong work ethic. However, Kansas has always played tug of war with the dark side. If you've ever read In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, which is perhaps the most well-known true crime novel of all time, you already know this. In Cold Blood details the 1959 savage murders of 4 members of the Herbert Clutter family in the small farming community of Holcomb, Kansas. Our sense of security was shattered again when a devoted family man terrorized the Wichita, Kansas area. Dennis Rader, or the BTK killer for bind, torture, kill, committed 10 sadistic murders between 1974 and 1991. He did this all while maintaining his family life, work life, and church life. If horrendous things like this can happen in the heartland, they can happen anywhere. The next time you see your neighbors in passing, ask yourself this: how well do you really know them? So the case I'm covering today is a fairly recent one.
That's unusual. You always cover the ones from like the 1400s. That I'm like, who the shit is this person?
So I was still surprised, though. No other podcast that I've seen has covered this yet. At least none that I found. So this all takes place in Wichita, Kansas, which is the largest city in Kansas. Arkansas.
I swear to God.
So the metro area is around 645,000 people, a little smaller than Little Rock Metro. Wichita's the birthplace of White Castle.
I love White Castle.
I do too.
Just so you know.
I do too. And Crystal, give me all those little sliders. Yeah.
The Crystal Burgers now. I'm a Memphis girl, man. Crystal,
I love those.
Oh, and they come in the little box. Oh, yep. So good. Yep. God, we digress. Go. I'm already hungry. Go.
And Pizza Hut.
I had Pizza Hut the last 2 days. Also
we
my favorite.
We love White Castle and Pizza Hut. Okay.
We do not cook.
So those are a couple fun facts before we get into the darker stuff. Mickey Davis, who was a loving mother and grandmother, backbone of her family. In every picture I found of her, she's smiling big, usually holding one of her grandbabies. On April 9th, 2017, she went to her son's ex-girlfriend's house to pick up some of his belongings. So her grandson, who was 9 years old at the time, joined her. I'm not sure if he just happened to be there for the day or what, but he tagged along. Rachel Hilliard was the ex, and she let Mickey and her grandson inside to gather the things. So Mickey wasn't completely sure about all the items in the house. She didn't really know what belonged to her son, what belonged to Rachel. So she was asking Rachel if a certain painting belonged to him or not. And then that was the point. Things took a turn. And Rachel started wrestling Mickey.
The grandma.
The ex started wrestling the grandma.
So she, this is
Mickey's the grandma.
This is her kid. Rachel's kid.
No. Okay. Mickey is going to Rachel's house. Her son was dating Rachel.
Oh, so okay. See, okay.
It's kind of confusing.
So she was asking,
instead of Rachel's ex picking up the stuff, his mom was picking the stuff up. Rachel started wrestling her completely without warning, too. She jumped on Mickey and started beating her up. So luckily, Mickey's grandson fled the scene immediately. You know, the 9-year-old boy. He ran to his grandma's truck and called 911 from her cell phone.
that's what your son would do. He would know exactly what to do in this situation.
Oh, Max.
Yeah, he'd be like, okay, this is what I've been trained. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
So the police quickly arrived and found a horrendous scene. They found the grandmother, Mickey Davis, in the garage, decapitated. So a later autopsy revealed that Mickey had bruises on her head and cracked ribs. Luckily, the grandson did not see any of the murder or the decapitation. Still, though, terrible. Police found Mickey's severed head in the kitchen sink. They found Rachel hiding in the bathroom, covered in blood.
Where's the grandbaby? And
they arrested, he ran out to the grandma's truck, called 911, locked himself in there. Smart kid.
Oh, my God.
This is a mess. Well, he didn't see any.
He just saw them
Rachel
wrestling.
Started beating on Mickey, his grandma. He bolts immediately. Uh-huh. He doesn't see any knives. Uh-huh. None of that.
Is this like a grandma? Like a?
Yeah, she's in her 60s.
Well, my mom's in her 60s, but I wish somebody would try to jump on my mama. I'm just saying. There's 60 year olds, and then there's like.
She's not. She doesn't look
like
frail.
Aunt
I don't
be like my mammal. You know.
From what I could tell, the grandson just said it happened out of nowhere. She just started getting attacked. So, when they found Rachel and asked why she did it, she said the voices in her head told her to, and that God told her to.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, so you can see where this is going to go. So, before I get into all the trial goodies, let me tell you about a little backstory on Rachel Hilliard. At 2:25 a.m. on April 6th, 3 days before the murder, she posted something strange on Facebook. So because this is a super new case, I saw so much stuff on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. She posted, "Please don't let them cut my head off anymore." 3 days before the murder. Just an hour before she posted that, she posted, "Well, my psychopathic serial killers for beginners in training class is over for the day. Woo. Now for homework time or what, kids?" Very strange. So I went down a rabbit hole on Rachel's Facebook and Instagram. You know, I love snooping on people.
Girl.
And because this is a modern case, I went.
I'm going to snoop this whenever this is
over. For whatever reason, she's known as Rachel Est, E-S-T, on Instagram and Facebook. I didn't figure that out. But it was a lot, and I'll tell you a little more about the post soon. Rachel was not very well liked by her neighbors. She had a long string of misdemeanors. She had been charged with assault, property damage, traffic violations, theft, and drug possession. She was using both meth and heroin.
Ugh.
And had been for quite some time based on what I read. Yeah.
I bet her skin and teeth looked amazing.
Well, one time she was stopped by police. And they found a baggie of 3 grams of meth on her. And as soon as they got her outside of the car, she fell on the ground and started screaming, I guess as a way to distract them. And then she grabbed the bag of meth and tried to eat it.
She's like, oh, this shit's too expensive.
Oh, so she was convicted of possessing drugs in 2012, 2013, was discharged from community corrections in May of 2015. So this is 2 years before. So just a few weeks before Mickey's murder, Rachel was arrested on suspicion of 4 misdemeanors. Assault, willful criminal damage to property, criminal trespass, and interference with law enforcement. Yeah. Long story short, she has a son, a young son, and
aww,
does not have custody of
him. Well,
thank
God.
And from what I could tell, had pretty much not been raising him. So she went to someone's home at 9:35 on March 19th and tried to force her way inside while looking for her son. I don't know if it's...
She's just, like, geeked out
right,
on drugs.
Right. I don't know if it's a foster family or, like, her own family. Based on what I read, it kind of seemed like it was a foster family that had custody of her son, but I don't know for sure. She broke a window to try to get into their home, and when police showed up, she assaulted an officer.
Rachel grew up in Garden Plain and attended a military school after drugs were found on her. She alleges she got into a really bad car accident in the early 2000s, and that put her in a coma and left her with a brain injury. I did see somewhere on her Instagram, she, right before the murder, shaved her head and showed a big scar on the back. Mm-hmm. She didn't really add any caption or anything, so I'm assuming that's where that was. So she had a really long history of drug use, and in 2011, one of her good friends said she noticed a change in her. She assumed she started using again. She did not look healthy. Her behavior was erratic, and she started developing sores all over her arms.
Mm-hmm.
One of her neighbors said that everyone on the block called her place the Tweaker House.
Sounds about right.
They said she would have random people there pretty much at all times of the night, and that she looked really sickly. According to an article written by Lindsay Calder, just a few days before the murder, Rachel was asking people for recommendations for someone who could perform an exorcism.
She was just drugged out. And, you know, I always side with an exorcism.
I know.
I'm always like, it's got to be a demon. I always believe in it's a demon. But in this case, not so much.
Yeah. So she found a guy, Pastor Terry Fox, from Summit Church in Wichita. I'm guessing, so he's not a priest, so I guess other people can perform exorcisms.
I don't know how well they work.
I don't really know.
Wouldn't go to an eye doctor for my yearly mammogram. I'm just saying.
I'd find a priest.
Yeah.
So he'd been doing them, though, for 30 years.
Well.
So he's had experience. He had a resume.
Because those can't be faked.
No. So she finds him. I have no idea how she finds him. She doesn't go to his church or anything. He goes to her home with people to assess it.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought demons were in her home or something evil, pretty much. She wanted him to perform a full-blown exorcism. But he said that after he assessed the home with his assistants, he didn't find any evidence of an evil presence.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I didn't really realize they did an assessment first. Don't know how it works. But he went in. He's like, nah, you're good.
You're good.
She insisted, no, we're not good. And he's like, okay, let's compromise. I'll pray over your house. So he did perform a prayer and blessed her house and all of that. Once the trial rolls around, we start hearing Rachel recount the story. And there are also several videos of her on the stand if anyone wants to watch them. Because I'm not used to covering cases that happened just a couple of years ago, so there's so much stuff. Twitter, live feeds of the jury, what's happening, like a news person in there, it's wild. There's so much information on the newer cases, I guess. Well, the big thing in this trial was not whether or not she killed Mickey. That wasn't, you know, up for debate. It was it premeditated or not? Was this first degree? Second degree manslaughter. So it's also important to note she did undergo several mental health evaluations before the trial and was ruled as competent. So she was even staying in a state psychiatric hospital before the trial and everything. So Rachel took the stand and said she and Mickey were arguing over a painting when all of a sudden she just freaked out. She said this, "I thought people were watching me from my own eyes. I thought there was an app on someone's phone so they could watch me out of my own eyes." And when Mickey's grandson ran away, Rachel said she followed him outside because she was confused because he was so scared. Then she returned to Mickey, grabbing a steak knife from the kitchen along the way because she heard something say, "house." She said, "These things in my head were like telling me I didn't have much time. You don't have much time. Hurry up." And the things told me I had to hurry up and let her soul out of there so she could be free. So Rachel said she thought Mickey was dead before the decapitation.
Hopefully.
Well, the autopsy found blood in Mickey's airways, which meant she was still alive when her throat was being cut. Yeah.
She used a steak knife and the blade broke off. So she went and got another one to finish the job, which is, I don't want to get too gruesome here, but.
Do it.
That seems way too hard to cut someone's head off with a steak knife.
Seems a lot. Not my steak knives. You're not cutting anybody's head off.
I can barely cut a steak with my steak knives.
No.
You know what I mean, though? Like, it took two, but she did it with two steak knives. That seems too easy.
So she was cutting, it broke, she went and got another one to finish it. Why should, anyway, continue.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that's, obviously, that's terrible, but I would think it would take more than steak knives, but it didn't in this case.
I've never cut anyone's head off.
Yeah, I cannot relate to this. So, in her words, she was making sure her soul got free.
So open her mouth.
Yeah. So like
she
I
never
said,
seen The Little Mermaid. Come on.
Yeah, I don't know what was going on. I went through her social media posts. It was very peculiar, to say the least. She seemingly had a fascination with seeing images and smoke. Kind of like, you know, how people look at the clouds and see things in the clouds. So she has several photos posted on Instagram of her blowing smoke into the air and saying things like, "Look here, it's the Grim Reaper." And once she circled three spots and said, "Real talk, this is not a joke." And I have no idea what she was seeing here because I looked at the photo carefully. I couldn't make out anything. And on another one, she says she sees a skull, scorpion, and the letter S. And she wonders what it all means. Yeah. She also has a really cute white husky named Kobe in her photos.
Jesus, with the dogs.
No, I know. I can't help but wonder. I hope she was taking care of her dog, and I hope the dog found a good home. Anyway, on Facebook, on April 5th, 2017, 4 days before the murder, she wrote this. "They can try to cut off my head, to slice me down, put me in the ground, and cut me off. A little more, but what I'm sure they don't know is that I knew more than you all along. Yeah, I do. I'll tell it. It's true. I'll tell it. It's true." I don't know. She made that up. I'm assuming she did. I don't know. Yeah. So she's talking about cutting heads off 4 days before the murder. It's almost like if anyone found her in this state of mind, something was bound to happen. So Rachel did have a history of brain injury. But she wasn't schizophrenic. She just, you know, or anything along
those
lines.
Well, I mean, when you have brain injuries, it can make you not, I mean, look at the football players and
right.
sports.
No. Yeah. But like, it didn't make her schizophrenic or anything. She
right.
did have
okay,
a brain
yeah.
injury. And she even said in the trial that didn't have anything to do with anything. Not sure why she went that route, but, you know, if you don't want to hear my two cents, just skip ahead a little bit. So, I'm going to tell you my hypothesis. Let me tell you my two cents. So, I think maybe she had meth-induced psychosis.
Could be.
I'm not saying she's innocent or not culpable or anything.
Uh-huh.
I'm just saying that could explain her erratic actions and that sort of thing. I definitely think she is culpable, but I couldn't find any trial notes on them getting into this, but I think it's because legally it wouldn't have mattered anyway. The courts have generally not upheld substance-induced psychotic symptoms as providing for an insanity defense when the substance in question has been taken voluntarily.
Gotcha.
So basically, you do meth, you commit a crime, you say you're psychotic because of the meth, it doesn't matter, you ingested the meth on your own. Surprisingly, or maybe not, many people who abuse meth eventually develop psychosis.
Well, I believe that.
Psychosis is a mental state in which your thoughts and perceptions become distorted, making it hard for you to tell what's real and what's not. You may see or hear things that aren't there, believe things that are clearly false, and you're unable to relate normally to others. So, a 2018 review of studies in the journal Psychiatry Research found that 36.5% percent of meth users across 17 studies developed psychosis. Which is a lot. It's over a fourth. Meth isn't the only thing that can cause psychosis. Mental health conditions such as, you know, schizophrenia can trigger psychotic episodes. But according to Dr. Brian Wind, a clinical psychologist, there are subtle differences between meth-related psychosis and other types of psychotic episodes. He said that people with schizophrenia may have trouble with clear thinking and may show changes in what they look at and pay attention to. And people with meth-related psychosis are more likely to have hallucinations, causing them to see or hear things that aren't actually there.
That sounds terrifying.
Yeah. So the district attorney, Mark Bennett, requested first-degree premeditated murder. He said, she chose to attack Mickey. She also chose to put the garage door down and to go back inside and get a knife. Then when the first knife broke, she made the choice to go back inside, get another knife. She locked all the doors, shut all the blinds. She was sentenced to first-degree premeditated murder. And she got life with no chance of parole for 50 years. So she was 35 years old during the trial. So that would put her in her 80s by the time she could get parole.
Mm-hmm.
As for Mickey's family, they're just happy. The trials are finally over. Jeremy Rush, Mickey's son, told the court he would never forgive the woman who took his mom away. He said, I will never get over this anger. I will never not be angry. Rachel did read an apology letter when it was her time to talk. She went back and forth, kind of apologizing and then rambling about why she committed the crime, saying it was, you know, the people in her head telling her, but then she was sorry. It was strange. So she was crying during all of this, and you can watch it online. I'm not meaning that it means it's genuine or anything, but, you know, sometimes people have a stone-cold face when they're
sure
reading the crime. So I'm just always curious about that. But Rachel said this, I feel that even death would be too good for me now. Every day and every night, I am sorry. Before handing down the sentence, Judge Bruce Brown called the murder horrific. Mickey's family members say they won't forgive Rachel Hilliard for what she did, but they're slowly moving on. Regarding Rachel's sentence, Jeremy said, we knew that's what it should be, but I don't know. Just this case is so horrific that there shouldn't be any other verdict anyway, so that's just how it was. Yeah, just glad it's over with. There was a Justice for Mickey Facebook group, and her family wrote this. Tomorrow is never promised, so let your loved ones know how much they mean to you. Today, please do an act of kindness in Mom's honor. Listen to a Willie Nelson song, her favorite.
Aww.
Do something good for someone. We hope to have justice sooner than later, but we all know how slow those wheels turn. Thank you all for the support and love shown to our family in the last year. So, after this, I think we need to jam out to a Willie Nelson song. And we ask you to do the same.
What's your favorite Willie Nelson song? Seven Spanish Angels was, like, my grandfather's favorite song. And
really?
Every time I hear that song, it just, like, stops me in my tracks.
Probably On the Road Again. I don't know.
You're going textbook Willie.
Textbook On the Road Again. Just can't wait.
That's enough of that. Okay. Who are your sources? Okay.
My sources are the Wichita Eagle, Kansas.com, AP News, ABC News, KIRO News, KWCH News, and WebMD for all that psychosis chat. So that's my case. It's all going to pot. That's a good one. He has a lot of songs.
Yeah, he does. He's fantastic.
Bloody Mary Morning. I love a good Bloody Mary Morning.
Don't go through his whole music library. We'll be here all day. Do you want to hear about my case?
I do.
All right.
Let's get to it.
So my story is about John Edward Robinson. Do you know who that is?
A little bit, but I've forgotten.
There's a lot of it. There's a lot of podcasts about him, and I didn't realize it until I started doing research about him. And I was like, I should think somebody else.
That it happens that but way sometimes.
But I didn't know just how crazy.
He has a wild story, and he's not as well
known. Yeah, I know. It's,
I don't know why.
So June 2nd, 2000.
This was 2000?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
June 2nd of 2000, authorities find five separate women,
mm-hmm.
bodies stuffed in barrels on his property.
This is the main thing I remember, this part, yeah.
He had two separate properties, one in Kansas and one in Missouri. And they found two barrels at one location and three mm-hmm. at the other. Lacine, Kansas was where the two bodies were found, and the other was in Missouri.
Hmm.
So this is kind of the whole scab that gets picked off.
Yeah.
And then it all comes out. So John was born December 27th, 1943 in Illinois. He had a normal home. He was one of five kids, quiet family. He was an Eagle Scout, just the typical, mm-hmm. you know. Later on, he went to an all-boys prep school in Chicago because he wanted to be a priest.
Okay.
So, I mean, like, he would literally tell people, like, I want to go to work at the Vatican. Like, he wanted to go all the way.
Interesting.
Yes. So, he graduated at 17, and in 1961, he went to a community college to be an X-ray tech. So, I don't know what happened, but he just was like, different. Yeah, he was okay. Like, I decided against being a priest. I'm just going to go be an X-ray tech. So he basically had a lot of big ideas and mm-hmm. never really followed through with those. So he gets a job at a Chicago hospital in 1964, and he meets Nancy Jo Finch, and they get married. She was already pregnant when they got married, and they had John Jr. in 1965. They would go on to have Kim and a set of twins, Chris and Christine. In 1971. So, anyways, in 1969, he was arrested for stealing from his job.
At the hospital.
So he begs and pleads for them not to press charges and, you know, convict mm-hmm. him or whatever, as long as he pays the money back and they agree, and he gets away with it because he's a smooth talker. So he goes and gets another hospital job at a children's hospital this time. He got these jobs by forging documentation.
Oh.
He just, like, schmoozed all this paperwork
so
and
he
forged
didn't,
it.
Okay.
No. He didn't have any of this. So, and people liked him. For whatever reason, he just had that yeah. way about him, very much like Ted Bundy, where people just liked him.
There's just, yeah.
There's a yeah.
certain charisma.
He was very
or something.
Charming.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, after he starts there, he, is a med lab tech for a nuclear, and does like nuclear med and radiographic tech. So like he's doing X-rays and stuff of these children. And it becomes very clear he knows nothing about it.
I was about
it.
To ask, so he doesn't even
he
know
doesn't
how
even
to do
know
the
how
job.
To do it. He doesn't know how to, and it's coming out that okay, you're not posing them right to get X-rays, and also with kids,
oh
I know
my
this.
Gosh.
Yes. So when Max was little, he's still little, but when he was like months old, mm-hmm. he spiked a fever.
Yeah.
We took him to Children's. They had to do an X-ray to make sure he didn't have pneumonia in his lungs. So anybody who has kids knows when they do those type X-rays, like it looks very scary. It mm-hmm. looks like some kind of medieval torture device. They put him in yeah. this clear plastic thing. They're sitting up like on a stool. Their arms are raised. It smashes their, I mean, it doesn't hurt them, but it looks scary.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you gotta know
yeah.
how to put them in, not pinch them. You know what I'm saying?
Why wouldn't he forge his way into a easier job? That's what
right? So, it's becoming very clear that he doesn't know what he's doing. Co-workers would go on to say that they were constantly being accosted by him. He was very flirty. He came on to them all the time. And he would also go out to clubs all the time without his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just kind of
he's
a piece of shit all the way around, sounds like.
Yeah.
He was also into BDSM, which, you know what that stands for, it's in a nutshell, bondage, discipline, domination, submission, and sadism and masochism. So it's kind of an umbrella term for sexual practices involving physical control and psychological power or pain. It's not a lot of people's jam. Some people are into it. People that usually take on these roles, they want the inequality of power. They want someone else to have the power over them. Mm-hmm. And just kind of, anyways.
Or they want the power.
Or they want the power. Yeah. So just Google it, y'all. It would be like a 3-day podcast. Yeah. So.
What's it called? 50 Shades of Grey.
I've
never seen the movie, so I don't know if it's.
Or even if you read the books, don't base. Okay, never mind. Or associate.
Scratch that.
The BDSM community with
that
has been, you know, played out in Hollywood.
That's true.
That's reaching. That's a stretch.
Okay. I've never honestly seen the movie, so.
I mean, they're good, but they're.
It's not necessarily.
Okay. Correct. Gotcha. Usually this BDSM community, people who know and are into it, informed consent of both parties is a must.
Yes.
You have to get consent. And people make fun and say things about safe words and all that. You need those boundaries.
Oh, yeah.
Because sometimes people get into things that in situations when they are practicing this that could be painful, deadly, hurt you, so it's just, anyways. So he doesn't always get full consent, which is a huge red flag if anybody is into this and are listening and thinking about going into that.
Consent is important.
Consent's important. Respect's important.
Yeah.
Anyways, his wife was not into this lifestyle at all. And instead of trying to kind of have a talk with her about his kinks, things that he enjoys, he just would go out and pick up girls at clubs. And
did she know?
She had to know. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't, I mean, I don't know. But she had to. So, anyways, that's how he was kind of getting his whole fetish itch scratched, was by going out and blah, 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 picking up chicks. I feel like this is pretty typical for a lot of men in this BDSM lifestyle, is they don't have a partner that supports their fetishes or kinks. Mm-hmm. So they, or maybe they've told them about it and they think they're a weirdo or a freak and they shame them. And so they go out and do these things on the DL. Anyways, so he hides this lifestyle from his wife and kids, obviously. Anyways, we're not kink shaming. We don't do this on this show, on this podcast. Just do whatever you want to do. We don't care as long as it's not.
Don't kill people.
Don't kill people.
Don't rape people.
Don't rape people. Unless you get consent and it's like that's their jam and that's their thing. Anyways, he gets fired from the children's hospital, go figure. And then he goes to work at another hospital.
Golly.
By this doctor, who was just super nice, so he hires him and he starts stealing money. Like, so much money that the doctor couldn't even pay his employees their Christmas bonuses.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, like a shitload of money. Like, he would go in and literally tell people, like, you can pay cash for this or whatever, and he would take it and pocket it and wouldn't pay the bill. Like, he would just take it.
Wow.
Like, he was, So, he also had affairs with multiple coworkers and patients.
Oh, my God.
And he would tell them that his wife was terminally ill. And she didn't care that he was doing this because she was terminally ill. And so, she was like, I know you need to have sex so you can do these things. You have my blessing. Which was, he's something. So finally, he gets caught stealing. The doctor presses charges this time, and he is arrested for embezzling between $100,000 and $300,000 from the practice.
Oh my gosh.
Which nowadays is the equivalent of how much do you think? $900,000. Almost $1 million. He gets 3 years probation.
Probation?
3 years probation. Wow. Like, that's embezzlement. Are you kidding me? You get 3 years probation? Yeah. So, in 1969, he forges more paperwork and says he is a system analyst and gets a job at Mobil Oil.
Wow.
Yeah. His credentials are complete shit, but he is a smooth talker.
He's obviously pretty confident, too. He's
very confident and arrogant, and that goes a long way. It really goes a long way.
It does.
And he's very charming, and he has talked his way into now a systems analyst position at Mobil Oil. I wouldn't even know. No, I would. Page turn. So he goes so far as he convinces the parole and probation board that he is fine and he will do right from now on, and they write him a letter of recommendation. Yeah, but he gets fired from this job too for stealing 6,000 stamps.
Stamps?
Yes. No jail time. Nothing. He's violated parole. He's now, steal stamps. So in 1970, he moves to Chicago. Kansas makes him come back because he was on probation. So what does he do now that he's been fired from everywhere? He opens his own business, a medical consulting firm.
So random.
He's like that guy that pretended to be not a Vanderbilt, but a Rockefeller.
Oh,
the guy
yeah.
that pretended to be a Rockefeller and had that whole thing. Mm-hmm. This is like the talented Mr. Ripley, too. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. So he opens up his own business as a medical consulting firm. In 1971, though, he goes to jail for a parole violation.
What did he do to violate his parole?
What hasn't he done? I mean, hell. Well, yeah. It's just, anyways.
What did he get caught for?
So he starts creating fake letters to get companies to invest in him from other companies. So he's like, I'm this company. Here are all my letters of recommendations from Johnson & Johnson and Walgreens and all these other places that are, so see, they trust me with your money, so you should give me your money. So these people start investing. So he now has, this is security fraud at this point.
Yeah, that's,
this is a, bad. This is big time. Mm-hmm. And he's just doing the shit. So he buys his family a big, giant house in a very upscale neighborhood. He is a scoutmaster. He's a Sunday school teacher. He is a baseball coach for kids. They even had horses, like in a stable. And he was the local Santa at Christmas time. Everybody loved this man.
How did he have time to do all this?
I have no idea.
Lie about everything in life.
I'm trying to do research, mow my yard, work 40 hours, take my kid. No. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Much less make a fake life that you're remembering. And
a consulting firm and you have millions of dollars and you're just like.
He's deep into Photoshop with fake letterhead.
Listen. So, wife is finally ready to file for divorce at this point.
I don't blame her.
But the kids beg her not to. Because he's a good dad. All this being considered. He is a good dad.
Okay. So he's not abusive to
his
children?
No. Or his wife. Okay. He's not abusive to anybody. He's just a liar and a cheat. So anyways, now everything's kind of coming out.
Yeah.
So he's fighting with his wife. He's being mean to his kids. But I mean, he's not abusing them. They're just, anyways. He's very hypersexual around people, married women, neighbors, wives of employees. I mean, he's just
messy.
He's very messy. In 1979, probation ends, and he is working at Guy's Foods, which is like a corporate. Mm-hmm. He's not at the grocery store. So he starts stealing and having an affair. He went so far as to create a fake employee. So he's working at this food. Mm-hmm. Like corporate office for like, he's like at a corporate Kroger. Okay, so he's like at their headquarters and he's doing like employee relation stuff. And like, he's in charge of all of that.
So he
makes up an employee name, social security number, D doot, doot, doot.
Wow.
And is putting in their time every week and is taking that money too. Like he's getting two checks. Yeah. So he now rents an apartment, and that's where he would take his women and have sex with them, have his affairs. So the secretary that works for him at this company gives him an ultimatum because she finds out he's doodling other girls. Leave your wife or I'm telling on you. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, I can't. So she gives him the ultimatum, marry me or I'm telling on everything that you've been doing. And he's like, no, I'm not going to leave my wife and do that. And so she tells. She's like, all right, okay, I'm going to tell then. She was not playing. So he gets fired. He gets felony theft charges. He has to pay back $50,000 and 60 days in jail. And then he gets out and starts another company.
Gosh.
So, yes. In 1984, Paula Godfrey comes on to work for this company that he's created, and she's 19. She's very smart. She's a published author. She's classically trained in, like, instruments. She's a figure skater. And he tells her he has hired her and a couple other girls, and he's sending them for a training in San Antonio. So September 1st, 1984, he picks her up from her house to take her to the airport, and she's never seen again.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So her parents lose it. They file a report. Robinson denies it. His dad goes to him and threatens him. And 2 days later, they start getting letters from her saying that she just wanted to go away and start a new life. And that she was never coming back and she didn't want to see anybody. These were typed letters, too. They weren't written.
No.
So the investigation is terminated because she's 19.
Oh.
So she's an adult. Mm-hmm. So she can leave and go do whatever. So the same year, he joins a secret BDSM cult.
Cult. Okay.
Known as the International Council of Masters.
International Council of Masters. Never heard of that.
Oh, well, we wouldn't because we're not into BDSM not cults. Not into a cult. Also, yes. So these are basically like business dudes who want to be a dom and really are like into like rape and torture and things like that. They have like a dungeon where they keep like sex slaves chained up.
So were they there against their will, or was this?
Who knows? I mean, it doesn't say, and that's the thing with being a dom and a sub. It's like, if you are a sub, it may look like it's against your will, but maybe that's what you're into, and that's what, so anyways,
in the true crime world, that can get messy in terms of when people's missing or death, that is it actually an accident
right
or is it not
something that
can get sticky.
So they wore purple robes and the slaves wore white robes. So his name was Slave Master, and his job was to lure victims into there to be raped and tortured. So he would like go to clubs or whatever and be like, do you want to be a sub, and this and this and this for you, and they would be like, yeah, sure, and they would, anyways,
yikes.
So in December of 84, the parole board gets a phone call from a woman from a nonprofit that takes care of single pregnant women, and she says that John Robinson had called and he had said he'd started a nonprofit organization with other businessmen, and he really wanted to help these women get, like, job training and housing, and that they could live in the duplex that he owned and get a monthly stipend, and he wanted to know if she could suggest anyone.
Oh, my goodness.
But only white women.
Why?
Because he's a dick. I don't know. He only wanted white women.
I feel like that would be whoever's answering this phone's first red flag. Mm-hmm. Like, excuse me?
He goes to a place called Hope House, which is the same type of place that this woman is calling from.
Okay.
But anyways. So there he meets Lisa Stassi, who is 19, and she has 4-month-old baby Tiffany. and they had just moved in. And he told her about his local businessmen who help mamas like her. And he promised her a job and to take care of the baby. And he introduced himself as John Osborne, not John Robinson. He said that he would provide daycare and help her get her high school diploma. So he takes her and has her stay with two other young mothers that are also at the duplex with their babies.
Why does he? I don't like that he wants women with babies and pregnant women. That's creepy. Well, I mean, it's all creepy. This is especially, what's he doing with these kids?
So he told her he needed all of her family's address and phone numbers. And then one night she goes and visits with her sister-in-law. She tells her sister-in-law, like, something's weird. Like, I just don't feel.
Yeah.
Like, this is just odd. So, he also told her that her mother-in-law had contacted him and wanted to take her baby away. So, she calls her mother-in-law and says, you know, why are you going to take Tiffany from me? Like, you know, I'm a good mom. Things didn't work out with your son, but you know, I'm a good mom. And she's like, I never said that. Like, I didn't, he's lying to you. And she's like, he told me, you called him and said that and told me to sign these four pieces of paper. And she's like, you didn't sign those, did you?
Why would she be signing papers?
I guess he kind of made it sound like it was like legal documents or maybe for an attorney to keep her mother-in-law from taking her daughter. Okay. So she signed it all. And she's like, you didn't sign it, did you? She's like, yes. And that was the last time anybody heard from her. Yeah. So the mother-in-law and sister-in-law call the police when they don't hear from her. And they go to where she was staying. And they weren't there. So they confront him. And he's pissed and says she left on her own free will. And she didn't want anything to do with them. And then they got letters from her, typed letters, saying that her and Tiffany had moved away and started over again, and they just needed to leave her alone. So that same night, he shows up back home with a baby who is dirty and hungry, and his wife goes and gets all the stuff and cleans this baby up and feeds her, and she's like, okay, where the fuck did this baby come from? And he says he went to and adoption agency, like a private adoption agency, and the mother had committed suicide, and he paid them $4,000 for this baby because his brother and his wife had been trying for years to get pregnant and they couldn't. And when he heard about this, he went and just paid for the baby and took the baby.
He didn't just call his brother to say, hey, go
he
to this.
He does call. Well, his brother lives out of state. So he does call his brother and says,
I don't know a lot about adoption, but
this ain't how it works.
Seem
no.
Legit.
No. So his brother and wife fly out the next morning
pick
baby Tiffany up. Because, you know, they'd been doing fertility treatments for like years and weren't getting pregnant. And it was like a big. So he tells his brother, I'll help you find a baby. And then this one just happens to show up. His brother and sister-in-law get there, and they have to pay him $2,500 for an attorney fee.
Okay.
And so his brother gives him this money, and he has all this documentation that looks legal. Judge's signatures, attorney signatures, adoption agency signatures.
So his brother truly did not
know. Truly believes, and his wife, like, I know my brother, you know, is part of this nonprofit, and I know he's all this big guy in the community, and everybody knows him and trusts him and everything. And so he's used this judge and attorney, and they did it all after hours because it was a private agency. So we don't have to go to court. We just have to sign all this stuff. They've already signed off on it. So that's what they do. Baby and go back home. Yes.
Man.
Crazy.
He is deep in scamming.
That's big time.
Imagine if he took all of this energy to do something legit. He's so busy scamming.
Mm-mm.
Lord.
I mean, and this family is just over the moon happy. They've got a 4-month-old little girl. They feel like it's totally legit legal. He's showing them the documentation. Why would they doubt him? That's your brother. And, you know, he told them the same story that this mother had committed suicide in a hotel and they found this baby. And it's just like such a blessing that she has you guys to raise her and take care of her. And like, I'm doing the Lord's work, basically. Disgusting.
Key.
So, side note, Lisa's body has never been found.
Never.
Also, sidebar, they changed this little girl's name to Heather, and she finds out in 2000 that she was stolen and given to the guy who murdered her mother's brother, and that's her mom and dad. They didn't know.
Yeah. Were they good people? Do
we know? That's her mom and dad.
Okay.
I mean, they raised her, and she's
with them. They weren't bad parents.
No, they were amazing parents, and she was 13 when she found this out.
Can you imagine?
Girl, no, it gives me chills even thinking about it. So they go on when all this comes
out. And that's your uncle. You're raised this. Oh, no. Mm-mm.
And he murdered your mother and stole you and gave you to his brother. It's insanity. Mm. So she's 13 when she finds this out. And they go on through the courts and legally adopt her. And
everything's
good and golden now. Yeah. So anyways, back up. So same year that all this shit's gone down, he's murdered these people and stole this baby and gave it to, the BDSM and slaves are chained. I know, it's hard to follow. So same year, he meets Teresa Williams, like randomly. Like at a McDonald's or something, like at a fast food place. He's flirting with her. You know, she's kind of down on her luck. He can tell. He says, I want to give you a good life. And she was excited. Mm-hmm. And he looks like a good dude. Like the pictures, like he just looks like a good guy. So he puts her up in one of these duplexes he owns. Like he'd been putting all the other girls up there. Mm-hmm. And starts forcing her to do sexual acts. So she's basically forced into sex work by him with his friends and coworkers, like BDSM stuff, like rough stuff.
Yeah.
Like, not the normal BDSM stuff. Like, there was no trust, no safe words, just I'm going to choke you out and punch you in the face and spit in your mouth. And yeah. So he wanted a master-slave relationship, not a dom-sub relationship, which is totally different. Again, Google this if y'all are curious about it. So we will not have time to go into this. Yeah. So he would give these girls contracts, which is typical. Uh-huh. It's not a red flag when you're in that lifestyle to have a contract of some sort. Get 50 shades out of your head, people. It's not like that. But the contract situation is very common.
That,
just to kind of lay the ground rules
that,
of
that makes sense.
This is what I agreed to do. This is hard limits for me, and I will not participate in any of these things.
Sure.
Also, non-disclosure acts are big because that is a very taboo lifestyle, and you don't want your shit aired because a lot of times these men and often women are very respected people in the community, and they don't want their shit out.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
So he would give these girls contracts and he would break them.
That's what I'm
He would never follow what they said.
So he was trying to basically trick them in the
trick them into thinking this is legit.
Okay.
This guy, this is normal and this is what this is.
That's kind of how he would get them there. And then once they're
there. So they're going into it thinking that, you know, we're discussing our boundaries and what not to break. And it's all about the whole pleasure and pain situation. And then, you know, he would say in his part, like, this is what I want and expect, but he would never follow it. He constantly crossed the line. Like, it didn't matter if you said pineapple or whatever your safe word is, he didn't give a shit. He would just break it. And so at this point, they're starting to investigate the disappearance of Tiffany and Lisa. And they point blank ask him, did you do this? Mm-hmm. And he is just shocked that anybody would insinuate that he would have anything to do with this. So, dead end. 1987. Catherine Clampett, 27, left her kid with her parents in Wichita Falls, Texas, and moved to Kansas City to find a job. Robinson hires her. He promises her new clothes and travel. She vanishes in June of that year, and her missing person case is still open. She's really? Never been found.
Oh my gosh.
So in 1987 to 1993, Robinson is incarcerated in Kansas for fraud, and then he goes to Missouri for fraud and goes to prison there for a parole violation. There he meets Beverly Bonner, a 49-year-old prison librarian. And so when he gets out of prison, she leaves her husband for him.
Wait.
Mm-hmm.
She's working in the
prison. At the prison as a librarian.
And she's leaves like, this guy yes. is the one.
This is it. Okay. He's the one. Wow. He's the one. So when she gets out of prison, she leaves her husband and moves to Kansas to work for him.
Mm-hmm.
Her alimony check is sent to Kansas to a P.O. box. She's never heard or seen again.
Is she still a missing person?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Several years he still cashed those checks.
Wow.
So now Robinson has found the internet. It's 1987.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. So his name that he is using is Slave Master, and he would post that he was looking for subs. So, submissive women.
Mm-hmm.
First victim is Sheila Faith. She is 45 and has a 15-year-old daughter with spina bifida who is in a wheelchair. He says he's a very wealthy man, and he will take care of her and her daughter. They move from California to Kansas City in 1994 and immediately disappear. For the next 7 years, he cashes their checks.
Have they been found?
Moving on. I know. It's like just when you think it can't get worse. So he becomes well known in the BDSM chat rooms. And in 1999, he offers 21-year-old Isabella Luka, a Polish immigrant, a job in exchange for a bondage BDSM relationship. So she moves from Indiana to Kansas City, and he immediately gives her an engagement ring. How do you get an engagement ring?
Right? Like,
I'm getting right real mad. Right out of the gate. Engagement ring. Yes. So he's still married at this point. He even takes her to the courthouse and they file the documentation to get the marriage license, but it was never picked up. She also signs a 115-item slave contract with him and gives him complete control over her entire life. Summer of 99, she disappears. When she disappears, he then convinces an LPN by day and a sub-slave by night named Suzette to move from Michigan to Kansas City so they could travel the world together. Her mom would later get letters from her saying that she was traveling, but they were all posted from Kansas. And then one day, she got a letter from him saying that she had run off with a coworker she's never seen again.
How is this guy getting away with?
Well, by this point, he's now become very careless and his not covering his tracks, and authorities are alerted after his name keeps popping up with missing people cases. So in June of 2000, he is arrested near his farm in Kansas after two women file sexual battery charges against him. Search of the property, and they find two chemical drums, big, you know, I'm talking about big barrels.
Yeah, that's not good.
Open them up, two women's bodies. This search prompts another search in Missouri, and there they find three chemical drums So the bodies of Suzette and Isabella were found in the woods in Kansas. And in Missouri, they find Beverly Balmer and Sheila and her daughter.
Oh, and her daughter was 15.
Spina bifida,
oh,
wheelchair.
Oh, my God.
All women were killed the same way. Two blows to the head. 2002, Robinson was sentenced to death for Suzanne and Isabella, and he got life for Lisa Stacy because her body has never been found.
Did he ever admit to any of this? I guess I'm jumping the gun.
I mean, he, smoking gun, you know, he doesn't have to. We've got you. You're, mm-hmm. Yeah. So Missouri has a much harsher capital punishment mm-hmm. than Kansas. Like, Kansas doesn't yeah. pay death. So his attorney opposed him being extradited to Missouri to be charged for those crimes. Mm-hmm. They offered him a plea deal in exchange for the other locations of the other bodies, but he refused.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm. He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't tell him. Nope. He's still on death row.
If you're offered a plea deal in that, why wouldn't...
It's just to be shitty. It's one more thing you can control. Yeah. So those people do not know where their daughter's bodies are.
That's the thing about not diagnosing him. I'm not a doctor, obviously, but he's clearly probably yeah. a sociopath.
Clearly.
And what is frustrating is they don't care. They're
no.
He's not sad for their parents.
No.
To him, it's a game and it's... Yeah, you're right. It's control. He doesn't have to tell them anything.
No.
It's just... God.
So he's still on death row in Kansas. So in 2005, Nancy Jo finally files for divorce after 41 years.
Oh my God,
marriage.
I forgot about her. This is,
yes,
they've been married
this whole time. And kids and grandkids.
Oh,
yes.
My Lord.
In 2006, Lisa Stassi's daughter, Tiffany, files a civil lawsuit against the medical center that told Robinson about her and her mother. And in 2007, they reached a settlement for an undisclosed amount. And she split the money with her biological grandmother.
Oh,
Lisa's, I know, it gives me chills.
The last person that talked to her mother on the phone, that grandmother. Oh, my gosh.
So, she's
so they're in each other's
chills.
Lives.
Yes.
Thank goodness. That's
so
terrible.
Awful.
Ugh.
It just literally...
Oh, that's horrible.
So that's my awful, terrible, just when you think it can't get worse case.
Were they... So the barrels, was it a preservative or was
no,
it supposed
to be... No, they were
decomposed
bodies. Yeah.
Because I'm just trying to think yeah. if that's the way he hid the bodies there, you would think
he... had a big farm.
You think he likely would have done the same thing.
Never found.
Kind of, so this is just, I'm all the theories are going through my head.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me wonder if he sold them to some of these businessmen in this cult, or...
Oh, it's a deep dive.
Has this cult ever been busted?
Not that I'm aware.
Is it still, oh my goodness. Because it makes me wonder,
as long as you're
too,
not murdering anybody, you're not doing anything wrong. You're consenting adults.
So the police aren't, there's contracts. They're, gosh, it makes me wonder how many underground...
Oh.
Things like, that's terrifying to even think about.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's my thought process. If they're not, and maybe that's why he's not telling, because he's sold them.
He don't tell.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Now that's going to keep me up on these missing people. So he's still alive.
And on death row.
I forgot all the details on this case, and it's just this bad. Refreshing my memory on it. Oh, Lord.
That's not great. Okay. So, on that note, where are we next week?
We are in Indiana, I think.
Indiana.
I'm sure. Home of Larry Bird.
Well, look at you. I didn't even know you like sports.
I don't.
When you're
married to someone, you get fun. I think he's from French Lick, Indiana, which also has a famous chocolate wine, I think. These are all random things coming from my memory. But no, it's the crossroads of America. I googled it thoroughly.
Okay, I was going to say.
I googled the crossroads. I think it's because of
impressed.
The railways going through.
Note.
Follow us on all the socials, United States of Murder. If you want to email us, we'll say UnitedStatesOfMurder@gmail.com. Leave us a review. A nice review. tell a friend about us. Do all those things.
All the things.
Yes. All right.
Bye.
Bye.